when the tribes of Israel first appeared on the scene of history, the ancient world was already very old and far advanced. Egypt, Babylonia had already developed high material civilizations and built great empires. Their arts and literature had reached a fairly high degree of development. The discoveries of the works of art in the tomb of Tutankhamun, you may recall, in Egypt, date from about the 15th century before the Common Era, approximately the time when the Hebrew tribes enter recorded history. And the pyramids of Egypt were built, of course, more than 1,000 years before that time. Our ancestors, therefore, were rather late arrivals on the stage of history. I call attention to this fact to help us evaluate properly the actual role which Israel played in the ancient world. The genius of our race evidenced itself not so much in the creation of new and hitherto unknown values, but in their transvaluation, in the transvaluation of these older values. The originality of our people is to be discovered not so much in the creation of something out of nothing, a feat, by the way, which no people has ever performed. No people ever creates something out of nothing. But in remolding old forms into new, in the purification and the sublimation of existing values, in the refinement of a culture which is found. Now, the land of Canaan, into which our forefathers migrated in the 15th and 14th centuries before the Common Era, was at that time the home of a number of peoples. The chapter of the Bible which was read this morning spoke of seven nations which inhabited the land of Canaan. It was the home of a number of peoples which shared a common language and a common religious tradition, by and large. Canaan, or Palestine as it was later known, was a main artery of traffic in the Near East, a caravan highway which connected great empires. Egypt on the Nile, Assyria, Babylonia on the Tigris and the Euphrates. And so that from earliest times, Canaan or Palestine was the entrepot of many peoples, a clearinghouse of diverse cultures, as well as the battleground of empires. It was not an isolated little country way out there, removed from the main current of the life of the world at that time. It's very much in the center of things. And when our ancestors entered this Canaan, they came in contact with these various peoples and cultures, with their differing religious beliefs and practices and ways of life. And their impact, the impact of these peoples and cultures upon these tribes of Israel, these Hebrew tribes, was tremendous. They encountered a civilization more advanced than theirs. Now, it is a rule of history that the lower civilization always succumbs to the higher civilization, even when the lower civilization is represented by a conquering people. Thus, the civilization later on of Greece, which was conquered by Rome, in a sense overwhelmed and influenced and largely determined the civilization of Rome. Now, if the tribes of Israel who had come into Canaan had not possessed something of their own, some native strength of their own, some inner strength of their own, some superior endowments of their own, they would have succumbed to the civilizations of the peoples of Canaan. They would have become just another people like the Philistines and the Ammonites and the Amorites and the Edomites, peoples who lived in the eastern Mediterranean and had their day and ceased to be. But these tribes, the Bnei Yisrael, possessed something inherent which did not yield to the new environment into which they had come. Something which made of them a people capable of fashioning a civilization whose rare contributions to mankind ultimately eclipsed the more advanced material civilizations, both of the Nile and of Mesopotamia. And they were a very hardy people, these ancient Israelite tribes. A vigorous and vital stock. One of the great writers of biblical history and the religion of the Semitic world, Sir Judge Adam Smith, writing of the Hebrew geniuses exhibited in the Old Testament, says, "The sheer vitality of this breed, both physical and spiritual, has been so intense, and despite demoralizations and disasters sufficient to have shattered other peoples, has been so enduring as to imply sources of blood and of brain uncommonly rich and vigorous. Their inner fire never died out of that nation. And though often slumbering, it was ready, almost always, to flare up at the breath of a prophet." And to whatever source we may ascribe these inspirations, he says, it is clear that the fuel necessary to them, the sheer human material indispensable to their display to the world and their tradition to later ages, was of marvelous strength and exhaustless powers of replenishment and endurance. This is something well worth remembering, because it seems to have been of the very pattern of the life of our people from those distant days to this day. Marvelous strength and exhaustless powers of replenishment and endurance. Now, the gift which this group of tribes possessed to a degree sufficient, superior to that of any other people in the ancient East, this unique gift was not scientific or military or philosophic or aesthetic. Our ancestors excelled in none of these. They made no exceptional contributions to scientific thought or military technique, or philosophic theory, or to art, except to literary art. In literary art, they did display rare excellence. The eminent scholar and archaeologist Professor Hall, in his classic book, Ancient History of the Near East, writes, "If the Palestinians as a whole lacked artistic originality and could build nothing but bare walls, if they lacked imagination as regards the works of their hands, if their sense of the beauty of form and line in material objects was blunt and poor, yet we know," he says, "to what heights and depths of imagination and imagery the poets and prophets of Israel could attain, dowering the world with a poesy, a music, and frenzy of words that is one of the greatest possessions of our civilization for all time." Our forefathers did have a rare gift for literary art. But it is in the realm of religion that the real genius of the race manifested itself. The creative originality of this people is to be found in its amazing sensitiveness to ethical values and its remarkable spiritual and religious insights. Now, to be sure, all the peoples of antiquity were religious. They all had their temples and their shrines, their rituals, ceremonies. Religion touched their lives at almost every point. And yet among no people did religion become so much a factor in the progressive unfoldment of the inner life of man as among the people of Israel. All the peoples of antiquity possessed codes of ethics and laws to guide them. But among no people did the ethical ideal assume such a challenging and creative role as among the people of Israel. Religious observances among all ancient peoples were supremely important as means of preserving social stability and security, love ensuring happiness in an afterlife. But in Israel, the ethical motive in religion, the ethical motive became the driving impulse for a continuing program of social reform and for the building of an ever more perfect society. Our forefathers entered the ancient world possessed of a very profound faith, in a creator and guardian God whom they called Yahweh. They traced their racial ancestry to Abraham, who was the first to worship this Yahweh, this God, and Moses, who led them centuries later out of Egypt in the 13th century. Moses was by them revered as their true national leader and teacher, who gave them a code of basic moral instruction, a Torah, which became their everlasting covenant with Yahweh. Now, the religion which they brought with them into Canaan was not burdened with excessive ritualism. It wasn't burdened with an hierarchy of priests, with the pomp and ceremony of cult and sacrifices, such as the Canaanites possessed and other Semitic peoples of the Mediterranean world. Their faith was a simple faith, but it resisted and waged war upon the elaborate cults of these peoples whom they conquered. Upon their cults, with their manifold and elaborate superstitions and idolatries. chapter which was read to you this morning reflected this challenge to overthrow these heathen idolatrous shrines and practices and to destroy that way of life. Now, in the centuries which followed their entrance into Canaan, the centuries which followed the days of Moses and Joshua, there also arose among the people of Israel a succession of unique personalities who have come to be known as Nevi'im, as prophets. A whole succession of them through a few hundred years, who interpreted the code of moral instruction which Moses had given them, this original Torah of Moses, and who taught them many other spiritual truths which were destined to revolutionize the religious thought of mankind. Of these prophets, these Nevi'im, the eminent Protestant theologian Cornille said, "The whole history of humanity has produced nothing which can be compared in the remotest degree to the prophets of Israel. Through prophecy, Israel became the prophet of mankind. Let this never be overlooked or forgotten," he says. "The costliest and noblest treasure that man possesses, he owes to Israel and to Israelitic prophecy." And what was it that these prophets taught Israel and through Israel mankind? These prophets taught them to reject the superstitions of the heathen all around them, to abandon all forms of nature worship and the indecent rituals which accompanied them. They taught them not to worship God in an image. God is spirit and therefore should be worshipped only in and through the spirit. They taught them not to think of God as a force in nature or a phenomena of nature, as the sun or the moon or the storm or the fire, but to think of God as the creator or ruler of all these forces and phenomena of the universe. And lastly, they taught them to think of God not only as the source of all physical forces and phenomena, but also as the source of all spiritual phenomena, as the source of morality, of goodness and justice, of truth and of love. They taught them that God is to be worshipped not through sacrifices, but through the just inner life, the good life of the soul. And they made religion and morality synonymous, one and the same thing. And they gave mankind the exalted new conception of what we call ethical monotheism. Now, our ancestors possessed not only a simple faith in an unseen God of justice and compassion, a faith which was destined to usher in a new era in the spiritual progress of the human race, but they also possessed, this is important to bear in mind, they also possessed a strong sense of freedom. A strong sense of freedom. And they held high the dignity of man. Our ancestors loved freedom. Every man knew his rights and was jealous of his rights. And he was jealous also of his dignity as a human being. And he was taught to respect the same rights, the same dignity in all other human beings. Now, when they entered Canaan, they encountered there a material civilization which was richer by far than theirs, but which had also become corrupt because of the inevitable factors which always attend rich and long-established civilizations. The ancient peoples were ruled largely by despots and tyrants. The masses of the people possess practically no rights whatsoever. Kings were worshipped as divine beings. Their subjects were their slaves. Among the tribes of Israel, however, royalty was instinctively abhorred. When they came into Canaan as conquerors, they had no king. And for centuries thereafter, they possessed no kings. And it was only when a grave emergency arose, brought about by the sudden invasion of the powerful Philistines from somewhere out in the Aegean, possibly from Crete, who invaded Palestine in the 11th century and threatened the very existence of these tribes of Israel. It was only then that they turned to their prophet Samuel and said, "Set a king over us." Samuel, the prophet who represented the true genius of the race, told the people, "Why do you want a king? A ruler who will oppress you and exploit you and make your sons and daughters servants and slaves. You are free men. Hold on to your freedom." But the people, in their dire fear of these Philistines and their chariots of iron, insisted, "Give us a king." And when they finally got their kings, Saul, David, Solomon, a whole succession of them later on, they refused to surrender to them their jealously guarded personal rights. And whenever their rulers overstepped what they regarded as their legitimate royal functions and prerogatives, the people rebelled and often dethroned them. And the prophets of the people were never afraid to speak up against royalty. Nathan defied, as you remember, King David. Elijah defied the great King Ahab. Jeremiah denounced King Zedekiah. The kings of Israel were made to realize that they were subject to the same universal moral law of God, to the same Torah, as was the humblest among their subjects. Now, this love of freedom, which is still a subject of contention and strife in our own day, this love of freedom was a new note in the ancient world. And it was one of the major legacies of Israel to mankind. The tribes of Israel had suffered a long and terrible experience with slavery in Egypt. They'd been slaves for 400 years. And when they escaped from Egypt under their great leader Moses, they carried away with them an unending and everlasting hatred of all forms of human bondage, a passion for freedom, and a reverence for the dignity of man which was denied to them in the slave pits of Egypt. And so they insisted upon the rights of every human being, the rights of the laborer, the rights of the citizen, the rights of the poor. And the prophets of Israel championed the cause of the widow and the orphan, the denied and the dispossessed of the earth. And nowhere in the literature of mankind do you find such eloquent championing of the rights of all men, even the lowliest of God's children, as you find in the pages of the Bible, of the literature of Israel. And this exalted conception of the rights and status of man is one of Israel's supreme legacies to mankind. A tremendous spiritual impact of the spirit of our people upon the course of civilization. And in time, Israel came to embrace within the circle of its high regard and love for man, not only all Israelites of whatever station in life, but all men. Just as their God ceased to be the God of Israel alone and became the God of mankind, so their regard for man extended beyond their own kith and kin and embraced all the children of men. And this too was revolutionary. In the ancient world, a man who belonged to another people, a man who was an alien, a stranger, was potentially an enemy. Even the Greeks, the most civilized of all the peoples of antiquity, considered every other people and the citizen, the member of every other people, a barbarian. The stranger was not loved. The stranger was an enemy. But Israel included within its concept of justice and love and equality even the stranger and the sojourner. Ye shall not oppress the stranger, for ye were strangers in the land of Egypt. And from this exalted conception of humanity and brotherhood flowed Israel's unique vision in ancient days of universal peace. The vision of a golden day yet to come when nations would beat their swords into plowshares and there would be war no more. Interesting. There seems to be also a golden thread runs right through the pattern of Jewish life and thought through the ages. Israel always looked forward to the future, to a better day to come, to a new heaven and a new earth. The ancient world in its spiritual outlook was static. It was either satisfied with things as they were or had reconciled itself to conditions as they were. But in Israel, in the soul of Israel, there seemed always to be a sort of a ferment, an irrepressible outreaching for a better way of life. It was never satisfied with things as they were. It always looked forward to a nobler order of society, to a time when each man would dwell under his vine and under his fig tree, and none would make him afraid. This is the heart of our messianic vision. The Acharit HaYamim, the good days yet to come, which mankind must strive to bring to pass. If I were then to sum up the role of Israel in the ancient world, I would say that it revolutionized the spiritual and moral values of that world. It refined and purified them and gave back to mankind a new set of concepts, a new set of concepts touching God and man and man's relation to his fellow men. It gave to mankind a new text and charter of human dignity, of justice, righteousness, freedom, and peace. Now, by the middle of the 5th century, before the Common Era, these major ideals had been fully developed by the leaders of our people. And from that time on, from the time of the restoration of Judea after the Babylonian exile, the best efforts of our people were devoted to two tasks. The first was to protect the people from physical disintegration and assimilation, because in those days, after the Babylonian exile, after the return to Judea, it was a very small community surrounded by heathen peoples in danger of absorption and total assimilation. And so one of the two main tasks of the leaders of the people was to protect people, the people of Israel, from physical disintegration and assimilation. And the second was to develop a technique which would enable a man in his everyday life to realize these exalted ideals which the prophet had set up, to define a detailed program of human conduct. And that we find in the works of the rabbis through the centuries immediately preceding and following the Common Era. The problems which they faced then were practical problems of survival and education. The prophetic enthusiasm of the earlier centuries is now abated. The heroic mood is gone. The age of the giants is over. But sages and scribes and rabbis are now the successor of the earlier prophets. And while the prophetic age is ended, the faith and the moral ideals of the race continue. They are conserved and defended by a devout and loyal people, which was prepared, when challenged, to pour out its very blood in their defense, as they did during the terrible Maccabean struggle in the second century before the Common Era. This brings me to the rise of Christianity. When Israel reaches the threshold of the Common Era, after 1,500 years of creative existence, it is by no means an old and decadent people. Its religion is not at all a spent and exhausted faith. It is still vital and challenging. And at this time, Palestine is still a crossroad of empires and one of the great centers of international thought and of religious syncretism in the Eastern world. During the 100 years which preceded the beginning of the Common Era and the 100 years which followed it, during those two centuries, the Jews carried on a most active missionary propaganda among the heathen throughout the Roman world and made thousands of converts to Judaism, even among the nobility of the Greco-Roman world. Christianity, which began at this time as a Jewish religious sect, appeared at this time not because Judaism had outlived itself, but because Judaism was very much alive and was still able to influence civilization and faith with which it came in contact. Christianity at the outset was not a revolt against Judaism, or the Torah, or the temple, or the priesthood, or the rabbis, nor did it represent a new prophetic upsurge in Judaism. Christianity was a Jewish messianic movement, which came when it did come because the people, and especially those who were carried away by mystical ideas, because the people at that time were expecting the advent of the thousand years of peace and righteousness, what we call the millennium, which was to precede the end of the world. And men were imminently awaiting this millennium, which carried with it, of course, the end of the rule of Rome, which was so abhorred by the people, and the coming of the kingdom of God. And this millennium, this thousand years of peace, happiness for all men, that was to be ushered in, that was to be announced by a Messiah, by one who would be anointed by God, the Mashiach, the Christ. That's what the word means, the anointed one, whose chief task would be to announce to the people the coming of this millennium so that they could prepare themselves through repentance, clean themselves of their sins, and be worthy to enter the blessed kingdom of God in this millennium. Jesus, a Galilean Jew, believed in the imminent approach to the end of the world, and he went through the cities of Galilee proclaiming, "Prepare ye, for the kingdom of God is at hand." And when Jesus was put to death by the Romans, Judea is now a Roman province under a Roman procurator. When he was put to death, his disciples, who saw in him the true Messiah, when he was put to death by the Romans, who saw in him, as they did in all other messianic pretenders who appeared at that time, dangerous rebels against Rome. When his disciples realized that the millennium had not yet come, and that the mission of Jesus, whom they believed to have been the Messiah, had not been fulfilled, they nevertheless persisted in the belief that Jesus was resurrected after he had been crucified, and that he would return and complete his work. And they continued to hold on to their messianic faith. And there soon arose in the city of Tarsus in Asia Minor a Jew whose name was Saul, or Paul, who was not a Palestinian by birth, who had never seen Jesus in life, whose training was more Greek than Jewish, but he was also convinced of the imminence of the end of the world, and that Jesus was the appointed Messiah, and that he would soon return to complete the work which he had begun. And Paul made the belief in the Messiahship of Jesus an article of faith for all those who wished to join the new messianic or Christian fellowship. Now, Paul was not content to preach his faith to Jews alone. He preached it both to Jews and non-Jews, to all pagans in the Roman world. And Paul soon realized that it would be much easier to persuade non-Jews to join the messianic fellowship if they would not be required as a prior condition to accept and observe all the laws of the Torah which were binding upon observant Jews, such as the dietary laws, the Abrahamic rite of circumcision, and the strict observance of the Sabbath. He therefore set these laws aside as far as the pagan converts were concerned, and as a result of the abandonment of these essential requirements of authoritative Judaism, as a result of their abandonment by Paul and his followers, a rupture took place which ultimately led to the complete separation of this messianic Jewish sect from the mainstream of authoritative Judaism. Now, there is, of course, much in Christianity as it developed in later times which is not Jewish in origin. There is much in it which may be traced to the mystery religions of the Greco-Roman world. The doctrine of the Trinity, for example, is not Jewish. In fact, it is anti-Jewish. Jewish thought had rejected it 1,000 years before. The doctrine of the sacraments is not Jewish, nor is the doctrine of mediation, the need of a mediator between man and his God. These came into Christianity from other sources. But the core, the heart of Christianity, is completely Jewish. Jesus was a Jew, and if his personality and his teachings have been a force in the molding of Western civilization, as undoubtedly they have, a tremendous force, and in influencing the lives of countless millions of people, then he is a gift of Israel to the Western world. Christianity is inconceivable without the Bible. Every page of it, whether it of the Old or of the New Testament, is the work of Jews. And the impact of the Bible upon the life and the literature and the art of the peoples of the Western world is, of course, incalculable. And the ethics of Christianity are Jewish ethics. There is not an ethical teaching in that remarkable collection known as the Sermon on the Mount which does not find its counterpart and its original in the Old Testament, with the possible exception of the teachings of pacifism and otherworldliness, which are not basically Jewish. But the essential ethics of Christianity, justice, righteousness, love, peace, the equality of man, these are traditional Jewish ideals. And rightfully, therefore, may Christianity be called a daughter religion of Judaism. Israel's contribution to Christendom, therefore, is vast, and its impact upon Western civilization monumental. Insofar as Christianity dominated the thought of European peoples for 1500 years to this day, it may well be said that it was Jewish spiritual and ethical thought which conquered that world. And its impact upon civilization, the impact of the Jewish people upon civilization, was second to none. I had hoped originally to compress all that I wanted to say in the one lecture, but as I began writing it, it ran away from me. I want to speak further about the impact of the Jewish people, of Jewish thought, of Judaism upon Islam, upon Mohammedanism, upon the Middle Ages, upon the Renaissance, upon Reformation, upon the American Revolution, upon the rise of capitalism and socialism in our modern world, and upon the role of Israel today. But of that, I shall speak next Sunday.